Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. Thank you all for coming. We appreciate that you've made the effort to be here. It's nice to see all of you again after a long absence from here on my part. This afternoon, we are very fortunate that we have Achan Sujato with us. He's an expert in Vinaya and also very supportive of the move towards bhikkhuni ordination. This afternoon, the way that the program is going to be conducted is that I'm going to do a short introduction and then hand over to Achan Sujato, who will speak about the bhikkhuni ordination, and we'll then give time for questions. That's up until 3 o'clock. So at 3 o'clock we will vacate the hall so that the normal meditation class can take place, and we'll move over to the reception area where people can continue to have an informal discussion with any of us and also to think about questions that they might like to ask or to ask those questions. At 4 o'clock we'll come back into this hall and then there'll be further time for questions, and then at that time also I'll invite the individual nuns to speak about their personal reasons for being interested in bhikkhuni ordination. So we hope that this afternoon you'll have an opportunity to learn about the issue and also to ask any questions that may occur to you now, and to think about any questions that might come up for you and have the opportunity to also express those later on. So now I'd like to, for the point of not taking up too much time, I'd just like to read through the sheet that you were handed when you came in, because this gives an overview of why we are having this seminar and why we are considering the issue of bhikkhuni ordination. So I'll just start with reading through. At Dharmasara, we are currently 10 precept nuns, which means we are of the same status in the Sangha as a novice nun. For official and formal transactions of the Sangha, a novice monk or nun is not considered to be a full member of the Sangha. When we started Dharmasara in 1998, it wasn't possible for nuns of the Theravada tradition to take ordination beyond the status of novice. Since that time, modern scholarship and a change in attitudes about gender issues has led to a successful movement to make higher ordination possible for nuns in the Theravada tradition. A higher ordained nun is called a bhikkhuni and has the equivalent status in the Sangha to a bhikkhu, a full member of the Sangha. A bhikkhuni keeps 311 rules, 304 rules relating to personal conduct and the remaining 7 rules relating to ways of settling disputes in the Sangha. At Dharmasara, we have always kept a level of sila similar to that of a bhikkhuni, but not as the result of formal ordination. Now we are interested in formalising our position within the Sangha, and this seminar is an opportunity for us to inform you of our aspirations and to answer any specific questions you may have about this. We can explain to you why this is important to us personally as 10 precept nuns and hopefully to you as members of the lay community. Achan Sujato will speak about it from the legalistic Vinaya perspective, from the view of modern scholarship and from the global Buddhist perspective. We hope this seminar gives you the opportunity to be well informed and to feel positive about being part of a process which we hope will establish bhikkhuni ordination in the Theravada tradition for women in Australia. Through the quality of your generous ongoing material and spiritual support, we are able to approach bhikkhuni ordination confident that we can successfully uphold the standard of sila that goes with it. Higher ordination would allow us to be full members of the Sangha for the purpose of official and formal Sangha transactions within the Sangha of bhikkhunis and in relation to the bhikkhus, the monks, and would empower us to be able to live according to the rules and traditions that were laid down specifically for women by Lord Buddha 2,600 years ago. We view the opportunity to take higher ordination as a very precious and positive move for both ourselves and for the whole of the Theravadan Buddhist community worldwide. But in order to evolve in this direction, we need to know that you as the lay community are happy to support this move. And I'd just like to mention as a PS that we're not holding this seminar this weekend because Achan Brahm is away, and we're making good use of the time. Achan Brahm is fully supportive of the direction in which we're moving, and also the Bhikkhu Sangha here in Perth is very supportive. And it worked out very well that both he and Achan Ramali were going to be away teaching elsewhere, and so to have Achan Sujato come this weekend allowed them to be away from Dhamma Loka and for us to also have this seminar. But if Achan Brahm had been here, he would certainly be here in a very supportive role. So now I'd like to hand over to Achan Sujato, who will give you all a further outline of the issues and the situation, and then I hope that you will have lots of questions to put to him. Thank you.
So, yeah, thank you very much, Ajahn Mahayama. Maybe should I? Is that okay? Is that sounding all right? Is that sounding okay? So thank you very much, Ajahn Mahayama, and yes, very good to make that note about Ajahn Brahm's support. We're not holding a coup in his absence, that's good. Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me and for helping to facilitate this process, and particularly note the emphasis which you've mentioned to me personally and repeated today of making sure that everybody feels like they're a part of the process. So that's really what this seminar here is today. It's not for us to sit here and preach to you and tell you what you know we need to be doing and so on, but to engage with you and hopefully hear your feedback or support or concerns, and to see whether we can get a good move forward with a good mutual understanding. This, I think, is very important. So my role for this next little session is to talk about three things that Ajahn Mahayama mentioned. There is the Vinaya aspects, some points from modern scholarship, and some kind of global perspective. So taking these in turn, first to look at the Vinaya. And please, I just want to emphasize that please, if there's any point anyone has any question, please just interrupt, okay? And I do want to make this available for everyone. Later we'll have more dedicated time for questions as well. But from the Vinaya point of view, so what's Vinaya? How many people know what's Vinaya? Yeah? Anyone got an idea what Vinaya is? Anyone doesn't know at all what Vinaya is? No? A few people looking a little bit unsure. Vinaya is what we call the code of conduct for Buddhist monks and nuns, and this is a set of the Pali Vinaya Pitaka is the one that we follow, is in the Theravadan Sangha, and this Vinaya is about 5 books, depending on how you publish it, but usually about 5 books long, okay? It's about the size of it. You can check it out in the library here. And it gives quite detailed explanations of the conduct for the monks and nuns in the Buddha's time. And, of course, it's a very interesting document from many perspectives, very interesting historically. It talks about a lot of social conditions and cultural expectations and so on, which give us a lot of information about the kind of the realities and the context of life in the Buddha's day. And, you know, it tells us even things like, you know, how they designed shoes in the time of the Buddha and how they built their huts and all of these kinds of fascinating little details. But the main purpose of the Vinaya texts is to give guidelines for the conduct of the monks and the nuns. And it does that through 2 ways. One way being you can say proscriptive. In other words, it lays down rules saying what not to do. Okay. The other way is prescriptive, by laying down principles, duties, procedures, which you should do. Okay. So some things you're told not to do, other things are told that you should do. And among the things that we're told not to do, of course, is the famous list of Patimokkha rules, which have in the Pali version is 227 for the bhikkhus, and as Ajahn Wayama just mentioned, 311 for the bhikkhunis. So when we look at that, one of the first things that we ask is, how come the bhikkhunis get more rules, right, than the bhikkhus? Now, this depends very much on your point of view. Now, you might think that a rule is a gift and a blessing from the Buddha. Yeah. Therefore, having more of them gives you more opportunity to train and practice and is a wonderful thing. On the other hand, you might think a rule is something like rules don't have a very good reputation these days. So a rule is something kind of nasty and heavy that you have to carry around. And even though being a nun was already difficult enough, the Buddha put on all of these extra rules on top of the nuns just to make things even more difficult for them. In fact, really the disparity in the number of rules is not particularly meaningful, really, because in many cases the reason why there's different numbers of rules is just because of fairly arbitrary differences. So, for example, in the Bhikkhuni Vinaya, there's 20-something rules which talk about the details of ordination procedures and how a candidate should be ordained and so on. And those rules are not found in the list, in the Patimokkha rules, the 227 rules for the bhikkhus. The bhikkhus have many rules about ordination procedures, but they're all found somewhere else, one of the other parts of the Vinaya, not in the list of rules. So sometimes it's just an organizational difference. And so the difference in the numbers of the rules really isn't particularly important. In terms of the content of the rules and why did the Buddha lay down one Vinaya for the bhikkhus and one for the bhikkhunis? Well, in some cases there seems to be a fairly clear reason for that. So there are some things where you can see, for example, that the Buddha laid down special rules for the protection of the bhikkhunis in certain circumstances, that they might need extra safety measures or something like that. And in some rules I mentioned last night, say preventing the bhikkhus from having the bhikkhunis using the nuns like domestic servants. Yeah? So there are certain rules which are there for the protections of the nuns. And you can see that's obviously coming from a culture where those kinds of gender-based expectations might have had an influence in the Sangha. So there's some rules that are like that. There are other rules which the bhikkhunis have that the bhikkhus don't have, or where there's a difference between the two, where it's not particularly obvious why there is a difference. Okay, and I think it's important not to overinterpret those kinds of things. The Vinaya is a system of common law. Okay, so that means it's just it was applied as situations arose. Yeah, and so a particular monk behaved badly, so the Buddha laid down a rule covering that situation. A particular nun misbehaved, and the Buddha laid down a rule in that particular situation. It wasn't a kind of a designed system which was meant to be kind of perfect and cover every circumstance. So in many cases, when there are differences, which are usually minor, between the bhikkhus rules and the bhikkhunis rules, in many cases that's probably just due to the accidents of history, and we don't really need to read anything more into it than that. Now, the vinyas as such, or the vinaya we're using in the Theravadan tradition of the Pali vinaya, is as an extensive and quite a detailed legal code. Generally speaking, the consensus of modern scholarship is that the essence, the core of that vinaya code was laid down very early. Now, in academic circles, because one of my hobbies, just for your information, one of my hobbies is kind of moonlighting in kind of, I pretend to sort of do academic studies in Buddhism, but I don't really have any qualifications, but I just kind of I take an interest in it. I used to be a musician, you see, so when you're a musician, you learn how to fake things very easily. So if you only play guitar, someone says, you know such and such a song, and you say, yeah, sure, so you could just play along and look like you know it. So that's what I do with my academic work. So I kind of hang around with in Buddhist academic circles and discuss these things with the professors and so on. And I was talking about this just a few weeks ago with Dr. Mark Allen, who's the head of the Buddhism section in Sydney University. And we were discussing this particular point, and you know, it seems very likely that the essential parts of the Vinaya hark back to a time that's very early. Now, from an academic point of view, you're very cautious about wanting to say they were spoken by the Buddha himself, right? Because you can't prove that. Right? So if you want to prove objectively that they were spoken by the Buddha himself, we have a hard time. But what we can say is that the core parts of the Vinaya have been accepted by all Buddhist traditions that we know of for as long as we've known of them. So they go back to the earliest period that we have any record of. And to me, it seems that the idea that they were spoken by the Buddha is really the only rational explanation. That's why, if you know, certainly in the monks' communities, that we like to argue about these things all the time. You know, so if you've hung around the monastery for a while, you'll hear us arguing about, are cheese allowable in the afternoon, or can you do this and can you do that? And so we like to argue about these points of vinaya. So how do you get the whole monastic community across all of India accepting the same code of the same rules? Yeah, who could possibly have the authority to do that? And quite seriously, who would have the authority? I can only ever think of one monk who had the authority, which would be accepted by the whole community without question for 2,500 years. And that monk is the monk who's sitting behind us right here. So I think it's very likely that the core of these Vinaya traditions stems from the Buddha himself, but much of the material, the elaborations, the details, the particular examples and so on, were all developed later. Okay, so there are texts which are in a process of evolution over several centuries, but the core parts of those, the basic rules, the procedures and so on, were established by the Buddha himself. So when we look at the structure of this vinaya, as I said, applied to monks and nuns, now the vinaya itself is called the twofold vinaya. Alright? That's one of the words it's used for it, the Ubbato vinaya. And it's called, they have the Ubbato Patimokkha, the twofold Patimokkha, the code of rules is called the twofold code of rules. And this is what's said to have been recited by the 500 arahants at the first council. It's the twofold vinaya. And when we look at the vinaya texts themselves, they're structured quite neatly and quite symmetrically with that kind of balanced perspective. Yeah? So there's the code of rules for bhikkhus, there's a code of rules for bhikkhunis, there's rules governing the ordination procedure for bhikkhus, the ordination procedure for bhikkhunis, and so on and so forth. So from a very early time, it seems that these texts have evolved with the idea that they're meant to support and provide the framework of living for the twofold community, the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis. Now, within that structure, in a way, to kind of the entering into that structure, the heart of it, the core of that is the ordination. Okay, that's what differentiates. That's what sounds like. That's the boundary line. Yeah. So when we do the ordination, we cross a boundary from the lay status into the ordained status. Okay. Now, leaving aside for the moment, leaving aside the kind of the in-between states, which is like the novices or samaneras or anagarikas and so on, which we use to kind of make that boundary line a bit more progressive, yeah. But generally speaking, the ordination is the boundary between the lay and the monastic status. And so that means that, in a sense, you're entering into the Vinaya and you're entering into that way of life which is governed by the rules and procedures found in the Vinaya. So the Vinaya itself, the first chapter, is one section of the Vinaya deals with the rules that I mentioned before for the monks and nuns. The other section, called the Khandakas, which deals with the 20 chapters dealing with the way of life for bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. Okay? And the first chapter of the Khandakas tells the story of the first ordinations and how ordination procedure was laid down. So this is right at the start of things. Yeah? How do you actually enter into the Sangha? How do you actually go to that place where these rules have a meaning? And that story in the Khandakas gives a kind of a gradual evolution. In the first stage, when the first candidates came along, the Buddha simply said, "Ehi bhikkhu, come bhikkhu, live the holy life for the full ending of suffering." And that was it, right? No fancy ceremonies, okay, no pageants, none of the things. Just come, live the holy life. It's very, very simple. Later on, and it's a very significant step, the Buddha empowered the Sangha to give the ordination. Okay? So when he did that, he did it by means of the threefold refuge. Buddhang Saranam Gacchami, Dhammang Saranam Gacchami. So these days we use that for the novice ordination. Originally that was the bhikkhu ordination. And that was very important because that meant that the monks themselves could do the ordination. That's very, very significant. The Buddha's establishing a dispensation which is going to last beyond the time of his death. And then finally he established the kind of ordination which we use today, which we call the Nyati Jatutta Gamma. So please repeat after me. Nyati Jatutta Gamma, which means literally a motion and three announcements. Okay. So if you witness the ordination ceremonies for the bhikkhus in Bodhinyana, then that's how they do the ordination there. And that's how ordination is performed in all the traditions of Buddhism. Okay, it's not a particular thing to the Pali tradition or Theravada tradition. They do essentially the same ordination in the Tibetan tradition, Chinese, Korean, Vietnamese tradition. They all do the Nyati Jatutta Kama, motion and three announcements. Okay, so essentially the motion and three announcements. The motion simply says, okay, in a minute we're going to do the ordination, and then the three announcements, three times you state, now we're doing the ordination, now we're doing it, now we're doing it. So it's a bit more complicated than that, but essentially that's what happens. When we do that as part of a sangha. So you have to have a quorum, a suitable number of bhikkhus, so that's 10 bhikkhus in the middle country, the Ganges Valley, and 5 bhikkhus outside of that have to perform the ordination. So usually a minimum of 5 bhikkhus performing the ordination, and of course one of those bhikkhus has to act as the preceptor, the upajaya, who actually the word preceptor is a bit of a bit misleading, actually. The upajaya is not really somebody who gives precepts. The upajaya really is a mentor. So their role is as a mentor for the student. So they make sure the student has their bowl and robes, they make sure they have the place to stay, they make sure they have proper teachings and that their spiritual guidance and so on is looked after. So when somebody's been through that Nyati Jatutta Kamma, then they're considered to be a bhikkhu. And when the ordination procedure was laid down for the bhikkhunis, then a similar procedure was laid down. Again, with the bhikkhunis, we seem to see echoes of a historical process. What exactly that historical process was is perhaps not as clear for bhikkhunis as for bhikkhus. But certainly the way the Pali text presented was that originally the ordination was by the bhikkhus alone, which would seem to suggest that perhaps in the early days, when there was a small number of bhikkhunis and when they were not yet senior, not yet trained for many years, so they weren't capable of acting in the role of a teacher and a mentor. So in those days, then the Buddha allowed for the bhikkhus to provide the ordination. But later on, the ordination was allowed for the twofold sangha ordination. Okay, so this is the form of ordination which is accepted currently in all of the vineyards which we have available, including the Pali vineyard. So in the twofold ordination, the first part of that ordination is done in front of the bhikkhunis. And it's actually very clear from the way the text presented that really the ordination in front or with the bhikkhuni sangha is really the important one. Okay, that's really the most important one. It has the most elaborate procedure, and it's where the most complete complete procedure is found. So in that case, very similar to the bhikkhu's ordination, that the candidate is first questioned about the ordination. And you may have seen in the bhikkhu ordinations at Bodhinyana, they have like a list of questions like, are you a human being? And things like that. Are you a man? And so on. So just to check. So there's a similar list of questions for the bhikkhunis. And then they give the ordination. And they have a preceptor, again, who does that ordination. I believe the numbers in the Pali Vinaya, I think it says there should be 12 bhikkhunis and 6 outside of the middle country, so a country like Australia, which is a barbarian border region, would be described in the Vinaya. Barbarian border regions like Australia, we should have minimum of 6 bhikkhunis to perform the ordination. And of course, one of the bhikkhunis performing the ordination should be the preceptor. And just like the bhikkhus have their upajaya as preceptor, the bhikkhunis have what they call a pavattini. Okay, so they use a slightly different terminology, and they use the word pavattini. Actually, sometimes in current day, they just use upajaya or upajayini is the feminine form of upajaya, but in the Pali Vinaya itself, it uses the word pavattini for the bhikkhuni mentor. And the bhikkhuni mentor plays exactly the same role as the bhikkhu mentor does in the bhikkhu ordination. Okay, so her role is to ensure that this candidate has their bowl, their robes, to make sure that they're a suitable candidate, okay, that they're not coming into the sangha for the wrong reasons, to make sure that they're looked after when they do come, that they have a place to stay, that they have all the suitable requisites, the teaching and the spiritual support. So it's very interesting, and I made this point briefly last night, but I just to reinforce that when we look at how the ordination procedure is described in the Vinaya itself, what it emphasizes very, very much is that those practical aspects of the support and caring for the student, yeah, they don't emphasize so much matters of lineage, tradition, sectarian affiliation, all of these kinds of things. We don't find them in the canonical Vinaya. What we find is the care, concern for the care of the student. And actually, I was quite struck by this recently. I was doing a teaching in helping to teach a course in Sydney on Buddhism and psychotherapy, and one of the people there talked about a very common teaching found in psychology by Abraham Maslow. He's called his hierarchy of needs. So any of you who've studied any basic psychology, you're probably familiar with this. But Maslow's hierarchy of needs, he basically lists a different sort of series of things which human beings need, yeah, in a hierarchy. And I can't remember what all of them are now, but they start with basic needs like food and shelter, health and to safety, physical safety and so on, and then to intellectual needs for education and so on, and then higher and higher needs. And when I heard this particular teaching, I was very struck at how all of these needs are actually explicitly catered for in the Vinaya itself, and how that showed how carefully that the Buddha thought about this and made sure that all of those needs which people have when they go forth are actually supplied, that they have the most basic needs, the food, the shelter, robes and so on. They also have the need for like emotional support, yeah, which is also very important. They're not just abandoned, you know. Deal with it, sister, you know. There's actually emotional support there, that there's intellectual support, teaching is provided, yeah, so they've given that. So every detail is mentioned and is provided for in the Vinaya. So when the candidate for bhikkhuni ordination has gone through that first procedure in front of the bhikkhuni sangha, she's then considered to be what they call ordained on one side, Okay, so this is a bhikkhuni who's ordained just in front of the bhikkhuni sangha alone. And then she's supposed to immediately then go in front of the bhikkhu sangha and then have an ordination just in front of the bhikkhus. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is, are the monks and nuns together in the first part of that ceremony? The answer to that, I think, is that the Pali Vinaya itself doesn't make that clear. It merely says that she goes to the Bhikkhuni Sangha, has her ordination, and then straight away she goes to the Bhikkhu Sangha. So it doesn't really make clear what the physical proximity was. Did she do that in some cases they were clearly separate. So in some cases she actually had to travel. So there were certain cases where there was Bhikkhuni Sangha and then she had to travel to get to the Bhikkhu Sangha. So that's only in a few cases. Whether that happened generally or not, I'm not sure. Quite possibly the practice might have varied. When I saw the ordination platform that had been built in Taiwan. There's a group of bhikkhunis in Taiwan at a monastery called Nanlin. And the nuns there have been very conscientious to try to revive everything exactly as it's found in the actual vineyards themselves. Yeah? So they're very, very diligent and very scrupulous in that way. And they've designed an ordination platform which they believed represented the actual original way ordinations were done. And they literally built an ordination platform. Okay, so they literally got a platform built, and they had one half of it was the space for the monks, and another half was the space for the nuns. I have no idea. We haven't talked about it. I don't know, Ajahn, if you've have any thoughts about that. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of those details, that's exactly the kinds of questions that we want. But yeah, these are the kinds of details which we need to discuss. For myself, if I was to say at the moment what I think is a good idea, yeah, I think it's a good idea to have the bhikkhu sitting here, the bhikkhuni sitting there. She does the ordination in front of one and then comes over and does it in front of the other. That would seem most sensible to me. Yeah, yeah. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Ah, when the time and it was done? No, it doesn't say. The as you know, the Pali Canon is very vague on dates. They didn't mention it, no. Why is it the twofold ordination? Yeah, look. That's right, yeah. When they first did the bhikkhu ordination, and they wanted to do they did the ordination in front of the bhikkhus. So, but sometimes the bhikkhunis would be shy or embarrassed to answer the questions to the bhikkhus. So then the Buddha said for the bhikkhunis to do it at that time. Yeah. The question of the dating of these things, there's certainly what you find in the text is a presentation of an evolution. So you find the presentation of a procedure which went through a number of stages to reach the form that we have it today. But what it doesn't tell you is how long that period took. No, it didn't. No. Yeah, it's a shame. It should do, yeah. So once the ordination in front of bhikkhunis is complete, then the candidate says Tavadeva, says right then, she's taken to the bhikkhu sangha, and in front of the bhikkhu sangha is given a second ordination. But when the ordination is given in front of the bhikkhu sangha, now according to the Pali Vinaya, the procedure is much simpler. She's not asked the questions. She doesn't have to go through the questioning procedure. There's no appointment of a preceptor. Okay, so there's no bhikkhu upajaya or preceptor. There's the preceptor is among the bhikkhuni sangha, and it simply goes through with the, what I said before, the nyati chatutta kamma is the motion and three announcements is the basic ordination procedure is repeated in front of the bhikkhuni, in front of the bhikkhu, sorry, is repeated by the bhikkhu sangha. And in that, the bhikkhu sangha makes reference to the fact that the preceptor is a bhikkhuni of such and such a name. Okay? So just making this point that the actual preceptor, according to the Vinaya, is the bhikkhuni and not the bhikkhu. And that the role of the bhikkhus is to acknowledge that such and such a bhikkhuni is actually the preceptor. Yeah? So the point of this seems to be that it then sort of ensures that everyone knows what's going on. Okay, here's the new candidate. Okay, because all know, yes, this is a new candidate. And here's the preceptor. Okay, so you know he's the preceptor. And if there's any problems or issues, you know who to go to and talk to about it. So it seems that the main purpose of it is to sort of formalize that relationship and make sure that the candidate's accepted within the Bhikkhu Sangha as an appropriate candidate. You'll need a bhikkhuni, yes, Anson. I think the quorum of minimum of six. So usually you try to get a quorum plus a few extra. Okay, so the question then is where would we get the bhikkhunis from, and would they be from different traditions and so on? And again, we haven't formalized or finalized these details, but generally speaking, the as I talked a bit last night, is that all of the bhikkhuni lineages that we have today stemmed originally from, of course, originally from India, stopped off for a bit of a holiday in Sri Lanka, and then went on a Southeast Asian tour, ending up in China, where they enjoyed spring rolls and fried rice for 1,500 years, before making their way back to Australia and so on. So all of the ordination lineages actually come from the same place. Right? Now, my feeling on this one is that the most important thing is not the ordination lineage, but the practice. So it's actually how the bhikkhuni's living. And even though, of course, from a legalistic Vinaya point of view, it wouldn't matter. You could get bhikkhunis from the Chinese tradition, from the Korean tradition, Vietnamese tradition, and I think that legally in the Vinaya that would be exactly the same. That's how I would feel about it. On the other hand, I think that it's better and more supportive to have bhikkhunis who are practicing in a similar way to the bhikkhunis here, that are keeping a similar standard of precepts and their padimokkha rules, and who can form bonds of community and like a feeling of oneness with the nuns here as part of a supportive community as best as possible. So there are actually quite a few, or not quite a few, but a reasonable number of bhikkhunis internationally, both in Australia with Ayesha Chinta in Melbourne, and internationally with several bhikkhunis in America and Europe and so on, who are practicing a good standard of Vinaya, and who are connected through teachers like, say, Bhante Gunaratna, who's a very well-known monk among us and is a good friend of Ajahn Brahm and so on. So we would try to find a sort of a key quorum of bhikkhunis from those bhikkhunis internationally. There may be other bhikkhunis, and again, we haven't discussed this, but there may be, or we have actually discussed it, but we haven't finalized it, but there may be other bhikkhunis from other traditions who might be present. My preference would be that if they were present, that they wouldn't make up the quorum. Okay, so they would be extra to the quorum. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I took her full ordination in the Si Lai Temple in California. It's a branch monastery of the Falkwang Shan Chinese tradition. Yeah. No, she didn't disrobe and become Theravadan. Just to clarify, yeah. And again, it's a point I made last night. There's no such thing as a Mahayana bhikkhuni, okay? All the Vinaya ordinations take place under the Vinaya guidance of the early Vinayas of the early schools. No, it's not that there's no discrimination. It just doesn't exist, okay? The Vinaya schools are established under the Vinayas, which belong to the early schools of Buddhism. Okay, which loosely you can describe as Theravadan, if you want to describe it as Theravadan. Okay, Mahayana is not a Vinaya lineage, and it never has been. Okay, it's always been, it's been a doctrinal school, it's a philosophical school, it's a school of meditation, but it's never been a Vinaya school. So the Mahayanists in every country, including ancient India, as well as modern Tibet, Bhutan, China, and so on, have taken the Vinaya lineages from the early schools of Buddhism, which are basically very similar to Theravadan, and in the case of the Chinese, the school is called Dharmaguptaka, who often is known as just the Northern Theravada school, and that's where they get their ordination lineage from. Okay, so the ordination has nothing to do with Mahayana. The procedure is done exactly the same way that we do it, with exactly the same procedures. Now then, on top of that, then they might do special practices or study special sutras which are Mahayanist, okay? But that's got nothing to do with the ordination lineage as such.
Could I just mention that we have a book to distribute to everyone, which is written by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is, as most of you would be familiar with him, is the translator of the Majjhima Nikaya and the Samyutta Nikaya, and is very well known as a Pali scholar. He's written a very clear document on to clarify this question about the ordination lineages, especially the fact that all the lineages that are presently followed by what we call the Mahayana school are following the Vinayas from the very early schools before the split. They are all the Pali Vinayas, and as Achan Sujata has said, that the Mahayana school is a doctrinal school, a school of meditation, but it isn't a lineage school, a Vinaya school. So we'll be handing out these books at the end of this session when we go into the reception area. And we'd encourage you to, if you have any questions on this aspect, to certainly take the book and read it, and then come back with some questions if you have them.
Ben. Sorry, I don't quite get that. You're suggesting? Yeah. The bhikkhuni? Yeah. Okay, so just have the bhikkhus ordain the bhikkhunis? Yeah. Okay, so the question, Ben's question, it's a very reasonable question, is why not, if in the early days just the bhikkhus did the ordination, then why not just do it that way? Then we don't have to worry about these questions of the compatibility between the Theravadan system and the Mahayana, or all of these kinds of questions. So, look, I think that's a perfectly valid option. And if somebody wanted to do that, I'd say that's fine. Some people... So just to be exactly clear on what the Pali text exactly says, after Mahapadrapati Gotami took her ordination, they asked then, how do we ordain these other women? And the Buddha said, well, I allow the bhikkhus to ordain bhikkhunis. Okay, so that's black and white. I allow bhikkhus to ordain bhikkhunis. And then the text more or less breaks off at that point. Okay, so it doesn't go into details right then as to how that was done and how long that was done, how many were ordained in that way or anything like that. More or less just says that and then stops. A chapter or so later, a few sections later in the book, it then goes on to tell about how the bhikkhuni, that wasn't satisfactory because the questions were asked were embarrassing for the women, so the Buddha introduced the twofold ordination. Okay, so that's literally what the texts say. Now, in saying that, when the twofold ordination is introduced, there's no suggestion in the text itself that the earlier ordination by bhikkhus alone should be rescinded. Okay? Now, just to make this clear, when the bhikkhu ordination is being spoken of, and I mentioned before that the Buddha first allowed by the ehi bhikkhu, and then he said by the three refuges, yeah, and then the motion and three announcements. So when he allowed the ordination by the motion and three announcements, he said, that former ordination that I allowed by means of three refuges, from today forth, that is no longer allowed. Okay, so he explicitly said, no, you can't do that anymore. Right? Now, in the case of bhikkhuni ordination, he doesn't say that. Okay, so there's nothing in the Pali text that says that the ordination by bhikkhus alone is no longer valid. Okay, that's just a literal reading of the text. Now, some people interpret the text to say that that ordination in front of bhikkhus alone was only meant for a time when there weren't any bhikkhunis, and then when there were bhikkhunis, then it shouldn't be allowed to do it that way. Okay, now that's an interpretation. It's a perfectly reasonable one, but it's not determined by the text. It's not stated literally in the text. So in that way, there's a difference of opinion. Some people have an opinion. Some people say that, well, since there are bhikkhunis, then you shouldn't do ordination in that way. Yeah. Some people, as you say, more concerned to say, well, just keep it within the Theravadan tradition, and then you don't have to worry about the Mahayana thing. So there are different points of view on that. One thing about it is that, really, from a Vinaya point of view, well, two things about it, I would say. One is to look at the spirit of it. And the spirit of the ordination, as I mentioned before, is clearly to provide the mentorship and support for the newly ordained bhikkhunis. And that mentorship and support is clearly meant in the Vinaya to be provided primarily by the bhikkhuni sangha. And that's why the bhikkhuni sangha has the major role in the ordination and why the preceptor is a bhikkhuni, not a bhikkhu. So I think in terms of the spirit of the ordination procedure, that's to be preferred for that reason. And that's very practical, you know, and I think that's very practical and very meaningful for the people, for the candidates taking ordination. They're entering into a wider community of nuns who they make connections with through that process and who will be their spiritual friends through the whole of their life. So that's, I think, very important. Then the second point is that, like a lot of things in Vinaya, well, it doesn't hurt to do extra, right? So in terms of validity, you're doing the ordination in front of bhikkhus anyway, so, well, might as well do one in front of bhikkhunis, you know, even if that technically is not valid, then you've still done the one in front of the bhikkhus. So increasing your chances anyway. So this is why I think it's preferable to do the ordination. The twofold ordination is preferable. Yeah. Yeah, I frankly don't think that's going to remove those kinds of objections. People will find something to object with. If they want to object with something, they'll find something. With some of the ordinations that were performed in India in the late 90s, and I think Bhikkhuni Dhammananda's was done like this, they first performed the ordination, the dual ordination, together with the Taiwanese bhikkhunis, then and the Sri Lankan bhikkhus. Afterwards, they then went to the Sri Lankan Vihara in Sarnath and then redid the ordination in front of the bhikkhus alone, Sri Lankan bhikkhus alone, so that they did it kind of both ways. So I think that's a bit excessive, but if they want to do that, I don't mind. Yeah. In some ways, this is one of the areas or one of the reasons why bhikkhuni ordination is challenging. Yeah? And one reason, of course, is a gender reason. And so in Theravadan countries, you become used to the sangha being male, and so that becomes an issue. But another reason why it's sometimes difficult is because of the identity, the school identity or sectarian identity. And so there's a feeling among Theravada that we think our brand of Buddhism is very pure and very original. And there are some very good reasons for thinking that, and there's certain respects in which it certainly is very pure and very original. And so we're concerned about that kind of influence from outside. I have to say, from my point of view and from what I've seen, is that the reality is, in fact, exactly the opposite. And this is why I see this as actually an extremely positive outcome of doing this kind of procedure, is that the reality is that just as an example, we did a bhikkhuni seminar at Santi Monastery, I think it was last year, was it? Last year at Santi?
Last
March last year. And we had bhikkhunis from different traditions and other nuns from different traditions. And when we all came together, we talked about Vinaya. And we used the Vinaya as a basis for discussions. And I find that there's a lot of interest among bhikkhunis from, not just bhikkhunis, also bhikkhus from Taiwan, Korea, Vietnam, and so on, who see that, there is this kind of way of practicing as a monastic which is very authentic, and they can see, for example, the way we go for alms round, and they're interested to do that and to try to see that. Or they see that we're not using money, and they say, oh, that's really, how do you do that? And so they actually want to learn. So I think that it's actually a good chance to give that, to help support that interest. Mm. But look, certainly in terms of options, then I think those are perfectly valid options to be considering. Yeah.
This question over here.
Yep. Without the need for the bhikkhus. Okay, so that's another question. Is there a possibility for bhikkhunis to give ordination without the involvement of bhikkhus? Generally speaking, that question gets into some fairly complex and recondite areas of textual research, which are probably best left unturned for the moment. But generally speaking, if the bhikkhunis alone do the ordination, they're still considered to be bhikkhunis. Okay, the candidates still considered, they're called bhikkhunis ordained on one side, and all the Vinaya rules still apply to them, and so on. And so they're basically considered to be ordained bhikkhunis. Yeah. See, that's something which it has actually happened, I believe, in one. I've heard in one small group of bhikkhunis in Korea that they had some kind of dispute or argument with the bhikkhus. I don't know what it was about, but anyway, they decided that they'd just do the ordination by themselves, and so they've gone ahead to do that. That's not the mainstream Korean sangha, but one small group. Yeah. So that's obviously not something which you'd like to happen, but it certainly would not be invalid from the Vinaya point of view. Yeah. Yep. Yes, okay. Good. Another good question. The Sema. So the Sema is a monastic boundary. Okay, so the Sema is what defines. Essentially, the idea behind a Sema is that the Buddha said that in performing acts of the Sangha, formal transactions of the Sangha, that all the bhikkhus or all the bhikkhunis must be present. And then the bhikkhus said, well, all the bhikkhus where? All the ones in the world, all the ones in the town? Yeah, how far do they go? And he says, well, all the ones in the monastery. And then they said, well, how far does the monastery go? And he said, well, make a boundary around the monastery. So it's a legal device which is intended to define who must be present for the ordination or for any Sangha procedure to take place. And the purpose of it, remember, the purpose of the Sema is to ensure that full participation, that everyone must take part in the acts. It's a bit like the Australian voting laws, right, where you have to vote, yeah, and otherwise you get fined. So it's a bit like that in the Sangha. You have to take part in the Sangha procedure. So then the question is, do the bhikkhunis have to also use a Sema? And if so, is it the same one and so on? Now, this is one of many questions in the Vinaya which is not explicitly discussed regarding the bhikkhunis. So what you have in the Vinaya is you have, of course, because the Bhikkhu Sangha was established earlier, so many of the procedures are just established and described for the Bhikkhu Sangha. Then when it came to describing this for the Bhikkhuni Sangha, it only talks about those ones which are different or in some way need to be adapted or something for the bhikkhunis. So that for the vast bulk of very many procedures, it doesn't explicitly discuss the case in the case of the bhikkhunis. So we're left to our inferences. And so in this case, I would say the fairly obvious inference is that, yes, of course, the bhikkhunis would make a Sema in the same way that the bhikkhus do. And it's there are differences of opinion about whether they should be the same Sema or whether they would need to make a different Sema for the bhikkhunis. The generally accepted practice, as far as I can tell, seems to be that the bhikkhunis can use the bhikkhus Sema. For example, there was an ordination conducted in Bodh Gaya earlier this year, and I believe that they used the Sema in the Burmese Vihara in Bodh Gaya. Okay, so that would have been the Sema established by the bhikkhus. My personal feeling is that it's better for the bhikkhunis themselves to establish their own Sema, and in fact, establishing a Sema according to Vinaya is actually a very simple procedure. So really to do that would only be a matter of a few minutes chanting and so on among the bhikkhunis, so it wouldn't be a big deal for them to establish the Sema themselves. So my preference would be for them to establish one, even if there's an existing bhikkhu Sema. Yeah.
So now it's coming up to 3 o'clock, so thank you Ajahn Sujato, and for everyone who's been present for this discussion. Now we're going to move into the reception area, and we invite you all to join us there. And anyone who has any further questions or wants to engage in an informal discussion can do that there. And then after the meditation class is finished, we'll come back in here for further questions and also for the nuns from Dharamsala to speak about their personal reasons for why they would like to take bhikkhuni ordination. So thank you.